So I'd like to start this second session of the annual Doreen Massey lecture event organised by the Open Space Research Centre at the Open University. This session is more about engaging with the politics, with politics and the arts through Doreen's work. I think Jamie Peck in the previous session described Doreen as a public geographer, and I guess that's what this session is more about. Thinking about Doreen as a public geographer, but I guess also more broadly the idea of a public geography and what that might entail. We're going to follow the format of the previous session. So we have another very distinguished panel, each of whom is going to speak for about 10 minutes, I think. And then I think Doreen is hoping to respond, and then I hope there will be time for questions from the audience. So our panel for this session, Michael Rostin is Professor of Sociology at the University of East London and also a visiting professor at the Tavistock Clinic. And he was the founding editor of the magazine Soundings with Doreen. Our next speaker will be Ken Livingstone. Doreen worked with Ken both during the 1980s at the GLC, as we heard a little earlier this afternoon, and also again more recently when Ken was Mayor of London. And last autumn, Ken launched a new project at Progressive London. Chantal Mouffe, our next speaker, is Professor of Political Theory at the University of Westminster, and she's been engaged with Doreen over a number of years in conversations around democracy and space. And our last speaker at the end there, Olafur Eliasson, is an artist based in Berlin, arrived from Berlin about half an hour ago, so we're very, very grateful for him. He's probably best known here for his weather project installation at Tate Modern a few years ago, which I'm sure many people here experienced. Doreen wrote in the catalogue for that installation, and Olafur was also a visitor to the Geography Department at the OU as part of that project. So that's our panel this afternoon. Those of you who've read the programme, though, will notice that there's one omission, which is Stuart Hall, who very much wanted to be here this afternoon but has been struck down by a flu bug and is not able to be here. I'm going to start, though, by reading a message that I think he dictated, actually, to Doreen shortly to have a presence here, even if he can't be here in person. So I will start with that, and then I'll hand over to Michael. So this is from Stuart Hall. It feels very odd to be talking for him, but what he says is, "Unfortunately, I'm not very well and keep breaking into a terrible cough, so I'm very sorry not to be with you today to celebrate Doreen and her work and to be part of a discussion about the political present. I've learned so much from Doreen over the years. Though I'm not a geographer, she has made me understand what a profound difference it makes that all political and social processes have a spatial dimension. I particularly appreciate the way her definition of space opens up new perspectives by running against the conventional grain. I had the pleasure of travelling with Doreen to and from the Open University, and that was when Stuart was a professor of sociology at the OU, and this was an opportunity for the most wide-ranging and entertaining conversations. I value the way she's maintained her commitment to politics in her intellectual work without loss of complexity. Her writing about place, especially Kilburn, where she, Mike Rustin and I will live, nearly persuaded us to call Soundings the Kilburn Review. She's been an inspiration and a wise advisor on the development of Soundings since its inception. I hope she has many creative and committed years of intellectual and political work still to come, as we all do during. So if I could now start and hand over to Michael.
Well, it's a great pleasure and honour to be here. Also, very enjoyable to be in this palatial establishment, which is quite different from the haunts of sociologists as a rule. There is no such thing as a Royal Sociological Society. Although, I must say, I did think this idea of moving the cloakroom halfway through was carrying an obsession with the particularities of space a bit too far. I found myself wondering this morning about, in this earlier session, about why it was that, in some ways, geography has done better than my discipline, sociology, in capturing the essence of the changes of recent years, and has in some ways, I think, surpassed in the enthusiasm and commitment it arouses from its students and people interested in it, what used to be the case for sociology. And I did have one or two thoughts about that, but which I think may centre on this question of relationality, which we might come back to. But let me get on with the main remarks I've prepared. which I hope are not too obvious. Dorian has always been, as we know, a politically committed and active person, as well as an eminent geographer. And indeed, she's never seen these two fields of work as being distinct from one another. She's always brought geographical perspectives into her political writing and activity, and political perspectives into her geography. Indeed, I see from the very first issue of Soundings that we co-edited with Stuart, in the first article of she published under her own name in the journal, the title was Making Spaces, Geography is Political Too. I've worked closely with her since 1995, when she, Stuart, and I founded Soundings, although we had a brief period together on New Left Review between 1991 and 1992, which ended not altogether happily. And we then started Soundings, and it occurred to me also that part of the difference between the Soundings project and the New Left Review project related to what Dorian had to say about grand narratives, and I think our collective loss of enthusiasm for a particular grand narrative as exhaustive of political possibility. So we've worked together on Soundings ever since, even though we're no longer the principal editors. It's a mark of Dorian's strong commitments and loyalties to what she believes in that she's remained fully involved in this project in all these years, as well as doing all the other things that she does. Now, her concept for the magazine was that it would encompass the widest possible conception of the political. We are, and were, a post-Fordist project, trying to make sense of a world in which the class settlement of the welfare state had, in Britain at least, broken down. We described in our opening editorial that we wanted to bring the whole of society into political discussion. Civil society, we said, but meaning by this much more than the market economy, which liberal economists have tended to equate with civil society. Since we felt that the established political structures, dominated by the political parties as they were, excluded much of life and society from the political process. This was a project of radical democracy. This commitment of Dorian's is the same that has led her to work for the Open University, the most democratic of our university institutions, for so many years. Dorian helped to make this very wide frame of political definition a reality in the journal. She invited numbers of scientists, especially from the Open University, to write for it, believing that scientific innovation was at the core of many social changes. And she also encouraged an interest in visual communication as a form of political and social discourse, especially through publishing photography in the journal. She also brought two particular theoretical focuses of interest to the project, each of them, as we've been hearing, connected to the other. One was concerned with cities, and especially London, and the inequalities between cities and regions in Britain, of which she's always been keenly aware, being, as we've heard, being strongly identified with her Manchester roots. And the other is globalisation and its consequences, which has been one of the areas of debate in which Soundings has done much of its best work. She's always been a strong opponent of market-led or neoliberal globalisation. She's described its damaging effects on the underdeveloped and developing world, she herself having maintained particularly strong links over many years with Latin America in particular, Nicaragua, Mexico, and most intensely, and of late, Venezuela. She's engaged herself in her links with these places in a continuing struggle with neo-imperialism, of which she sees globalisation, I think, as an instrument. She's also described in her book about London, World City, the damaging effects of globalisation and Britain's particular contribution to this, through the financial domination of its economy, on London itself and Britain more widely. A financially dominated economy generates inequalities both by region and class, she has persuasively argued. The relations of production of the financial sector are quite different from those of other forms of production, generating more inequalities and less social responsibility among its controllers and those in power than almost any other. She would like to see a much more diverse economic landscape, with cooperative forms of production, a commitment to use values, and the involvement of relatively excluded communities, including women, in productive economic life. And when she worked with Ken here at the GLC and in GLEB, she tried to give practical effect to these commitments, as indeed she does in her work in Latin America. Now, I think I've always had a bit more time for the globalising process and even the role of markets within it than Dorian has. That's to say, it seems to me that some credit does should be given to this global order for the fact that it has at last seen some substantial economic development in large countries such as China, India, and Brazil, and also in the world development indices in regard to such dimensions as infant mortality rates, life expectancy, and education, which have shown some significant improvement in most continents, with the significant exceptions of much of Africa. But be that as it may, and we might want to discuss it, the fact is that this system, which Doreen described in World City in 2007, at the very zenith of its power, has just imploded. It must be said, without much of a contribution to its collapse from its political opponents like us. It seems to have fallen apart entirely through its own contradictions and agency. But this now opens up a whole new political territory for us. What is to happen next? It does not look as if the status quo ante is likely to be restored any time soon. And certainly neither Doreen nor I think probably any people in the room, would want it to be. Now, this is in principle not just a matter of the hegemony of the financial system, the financial sector, but the whole ethos of our economy and society. Governments have long defined as their primary task, this includes, I regret to say, New Labour, their primary task to ensure high rates of economic growth in order that individuals should be able to exercise freedom of choice to pursue their ends in the marketplace. This, for quasi-neoliberal governments like ours, is largely what a good society means. They don't have much else by way of a language of aspirations. Doreen has never thought much of increased levels of material consumption as the main goal of life, and would want to see a rather different conception of social value. And there are now, of course, also pressing environmental reasons for this, as well as intrinsic questions of what makes life meaningful. So the question is, can we find ways of thinking about the future at this major point of crisis and change, which will help to bring to the fore more egalitarian, democratic, and relationship-based questions of well-being? Now, Doreen seems not to have anticipated this crisis, this implosion, any more than the rest of us did, except perhaps in the most general terms of recognising general unsustainability when she saw it. But here we are in this crisis, which may therefore be an opportunity to rethink the future. It occurred to me, I had quite a shock listening to the earlier discussion and realising that I had never really quite taken in that the central idea of the geography which Doreen and many of you practice is relational geography. And the reason this is a shock to me, because I realised that the relational is in a way the focus of interest of other areas of my work and also the work of Soundings, in particular in the area of psychoanalysis that I'm involved with and which Soundings has been involved with, which defines itself as object-relation psychoanalysis, and which means by this the idea of the innate and essential connectedness of individuals from the moment of birth with others, other persons, described in this strange terminology as objects, you know, both conscious and unconscious. And within that frame of reference, the definition of well-being in schools or in healthcare or in social services or in the workplace is about the quality of human relationships. If there aren't good human relationships based on care and understanding, nothing very good will happen. Well, that is a relational conception, and one might think that is a relational conception which defines a conception of the social good somewhat different from that of possessive individualism. And I must say I'm quite struck to discover that the primary centre, as it were, conceptually of what Doreen has been doing in relation to geography has never quite become the primary definition even of Soundings as a political project in terms of the kind of social value, the social world that we would want to see constructed. So from that point of view, I've learned a lot about how we might try to consider some alternative political imaginary. Well, now, I'm sure Doreen will be an active and creative participant in this new debate about what next. And it may be that she, and even we, could today begin to explore some of the possibilities that this situation may now be bringing into being. Thank you.
I'm going to stand up because I've been trained 40 years to stand up while I'm speaking. And I can't ever really break the habit. I'm delighted to be back in this because we had a debate here early in 2000 when English Heritage invited all the mayoral candidates. I remember the look of absolute horror on the audience's face when I said if I was elected mayor, I was going to abolish the existing restrictions on height and density in terms of development in London. It never occurred to me I'd be here giving praise for what Doreen has done and the involvement I've had with Doreen in her work and her in mine. over the period since we first met in 1976. I can remember, I think, the first time I saw Doreen, she was standing on a cold, miserable November evening outside the tenant's hut in Kilburn, where we were due to have our Labour Party ward meeting, because I'd just been selected as a Labour candidate. And I think it was an absolutely miserable night, and there was about three of us there. And I think you were the first professional geographer that I'd ever met. And I'd never had any desire to meet any, because when I did O-level geography, one of the few O-levels I got before I dropped out of school, it was mainly consisted of drawing maps, remembering heights of mountains and rivers. And insofar as it ever got political, I think the nearest we got was when we'd have the teachers tell us the role that climate and coastline had played in holding back indigenous cultures from reaching the excellence of the British Empire. And as I recall, actually, we only really focused on those countries that had been part of the British Empire, though by the time I was at school, most of them had escaped from the bloody thing. So my relationship with Doreen goes back to 76, and she was one of the first people I turned to when we won control of the GLC to try and have some input into our industry and employment policy. And she was one of my appointees to the Greater London Enterprise Board, which we set up, really, to try and analyse and then correct all the things that Doreen still thinks are wrong with the London economy. They weren't quite as bad then as they are now, so we didn't have a massive input in turning that round, but then that wasn't our fault, because an evil tyranny abolished us. And it was about that time that Doreen got the job at the Open University, and it was very interesting because she went for the interview and months passed and they never announced who'd won, and there was this sort of debate taking place in the shadow about why months were passing before they'd announced, and people talked about, well, would she have sufficient gravitas for this post, and given she had spiky multicoloured hair at the time, I could see she didn't look like the typical professor that they were used to. And then there was this point shortly after it had been confirmed that she got the job, when Sir Keith Joseph, who was then still in government, was wandering around another university and was introduced to the geography department, said he was very worried about the coming politicisation of geography. So we thought there might have been a political undercurrent there. But along with Mike, we had this thing called the area, after the abolition of the GLC, we decided it was worth carrying on those debates and what was going on and out of it. And we had this aerial road group, which is, of course, aerial road is where Doreen lives, where we turned up and had very intense debates over many years about what was happening in this sort of post-Fordist world, what we should do. People like Robin Murray as well. And there's also Vella Pillay there, a wonderful man, now dead, sadly. And he'd also been one of our appointees to the GLEB board. And he had this wonderful line, because my appointees had to be questioned by the council board and so on, where we had 14 of the votes. One of the Tories sort of suddenly said, here's an Indian businessman from South Africa. What possible contribution can he make to the dynamic London economy? And said something like, because Vella's job was raising funds for businesses, and said, do you have any experience of raising, say, £50,000? He said, none whatsoever. I seldom do less than 50 million. And he came along to say at one point that he'd been, because he was very active in the anti-apartheid struggle, in an advisor to the ANC, and got an early warning that apartheid was going to go, and the ANC had to come up with a credible economic policy, because as it was just a paragraph, very inspiring paragraph in their founding statement. And we started looking at the South African economy, and it was the nearest. I mean, it made the Soviet Union look like a liberal market economy. Almost everybody, there was a huge state machine, all in the apparatus of repression. The majority of the white population worked in the apparatus of repression. And then there were three great corporations that controlled 60% of the private sector. By the way, this is the easiest economy in the world where you could nationalise everything. Only three bloody companies, and you've got control of the whole thing. But it was that when I became mayor, we had my most embarrassing sort of relationship with Doreen, because she was pounding on with all this work about what's rotten at the heart of the London economy and what it does to the world. And I was mayor of the bloody city, and she turned up to interview me about this, and I always felt she was about to say, leap over and bang my head on the table. You've got to do more to change it. But it was the dynamic and the contradiction. I always used to say, when we're discussing it, and about the London economy, that this isn't the world I would have created, it's the world we're stuck with, and not any longer. And this is where our opportunities come, because the scale of what's happened dwarfs anything since the Great Depression. And I don't think it is going to be as bad as the Great Depression, but it's going to be worse than anything since. If you track what's happening on Wall Street and overlay it with what happened from the height of the market in 1929, the share prices are going down exactly at the same rate. And, of course, they're only halfway down if you're plotting that against what happened in 1929 to 1933. And if you look at the collapse in world trade, now, given world trade was much, much smaller as a proportion of global GDP then, but the collapse of world trade over the last year or so is actually greater than in the period at the beginning of the Great Depression. Now, the one thing we've got really going for us, which all the neoliberals really hate having to admit, is that, of course, the state sector is much bigger. And therefore, if you look at the United States of America, in 1933, when Roosevelt came to power, only 5% of GDP was in the public sector. And, of course, now, even in America, it's well over 25%. And therefore, there was very much less that the state could actually do. But it does mean we now face a huge potential for change and changing the nature of the London economy and making sure this doesn't happen again. I'm glad to see that after a slow start, Gordon Brown has started talking about the need to camp down all these little ghastly tax havens all over the place. And given that about 40% of them are under our control one way or the other, this would be would release hundreds of billions of tax for investment in nations that most need it, and also actually shift the tax burden within nations such as this, where far too many great corporations and very rich people aren't paying their share. But it's a question of what we should be looking to move into. And here, if you think the economic crisis is depressing, is when you start to look at the conference currently going on over in Copenhagen. Every new speech is more alarming than the last. But the Tyndall Climate Change Centre produced a paper in November that completely challenged all the sort of hopes that somehow we could stabilise the increase in global temperature at an average of 2 degrees Celsius. They said that basically almost all the estimates underpin the Stern report and Stern accepts this now, the debates about post-Kyoto, all about can we stabilise at 2 degrees Celsius increase. And they said the chance that's about 7%. There's only about a 50-50 chance of stabilising at 4 degrees. Now, geographers can immediately start to work out exactly what that means in terms of catastrophic change for many nations. Many nations bordering desert areas becoming virtually unable to sustain their communities. Inundation and half and the world's population now live in cities, and just how many of those were on coastal areas? When I went and opened an office in Mumbai, nowhere in Mumbai is more than a metre above sea level. And it's a peninsula surrounded on three sides. No question of building a Mumbai barrier around it. And the cost would be inconceivable. So huge change is coming. And I suspect that gradually as politicians wake up to the scale of crisis we face and recognise what they're doing at the moment is totally inadequate, there will suddenly be a mad rush to tackle it. In exactly the same way that we had to recast the economies of Britain and America to mobilise the resources to defeat Nazism, we will have to mobilise and shift the economies of the developed world to actually tackle and defeat climate change. So this means a huge growth coming in renewable energy and in a whole range of green industries and in recycling, because it challenges the fundamental underlying basis of what Doyne and Mike and many of the people in this room, myself, would all agree it's been at the heart of what's gone wrong. It's this huge growth of consumerism. It's the substitution of things for relationships. That growth of consumerism that was the ideology that drove the American economy in the 1920s, that came to Europe in the 1950s, and was beginning and still is taking hold in much of the developing world. It isn't sustainable. And therefore, what this crisis is about is not just rebalancing the banks a bit or a bit more regulation. It's forcing us to face up to the fact we really can't carry on like this. There isn't just another few more reforms that can patch it all up and get the show back on the road. The scale of the crisis coming with climate change means we have to fundamentally reassess basically how we do everything, how we run our cities, how we run our economy, how we live our lives. Because it is the case, to have any hope of human civilization surviving, we have to reduce our carbon emissions in the developed world by at least 80%, most probably 90%, by 2050. That means all of us. It isn't an abstract idea that applies elsewhere. It impacts on every aspect of our lives, every aspect of the way we will run our cities. And therefore, I'm delighted, my final point, to say that Doreen's already involved in our next great adventure, which is an organisation called Progressive London. We had it's to call together all those people that stand on the progressive side of the spectrum. So there's Greens and Liberals, as well as unions and Labour people and people who aren't involved in anything, and many academics. And we called a meeting in January. 600 people came. It's only focused on London and what we can do in one city. And I think there's a huge desire out there to now rethink where we are, the problems we face, and find the solutions for them. And I'm delighted that Doreen's going to be working with us on that, amongst doing many, many other things as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.
I also prefer to stand, not for the same reason as Ken, mind you, but it's because I'm too small, and with those deep chairs, I feel I can't really make myself visible. So, well, it's a real pleasure to be here celebrating the work of Doreen. Doreen and I, we've been very good friends for a long time, in fact, since the 1970s, when we were involved in the Hegemony Research Group, of which Stuart Hall was also a part. And since then, we've been meeting, discussing, exchanging, you know, argument about our work. And so it has been a very important intellectual dialogue for me. In fact, what, of course, brought us together at the very beginning was that we were interested basically in the same thing, which was to bring the insight of post-structuralism to bear on our respective discipline. In the case of Doreen, of course, it was geography. In my case, it was political theory. But we were both committed to the critique of essentialism and to the relational character of identity. So in different ways, you know, we've been following this trajectory, and that's what created some kind of synergy between our work. The work of Doreen has been very important for me for thinking about politics, because she really made me realize the importance of the spatial dimension in politics. I was not really aware of that previously. And I think that, of course, has got many very important insights for thinking democratic politics. I just want here to mention only a couple. There are many point that I could have insisted on, but, you know, I don't have time for that. There are two which I find particularly important for, you know, thinking about politics and democratic politics. First, the idea that Doreen insisted space is a dimension of multiplicity. She always insisted that space and multiplicity are co-constitutive. And I think that is very important, because, in fact, as she say, it indicates that space poses the question of how we are going to live together. And, of course, this is a crucial question, of course, for democratic politics. The other one, which, of course, has already been referred to in the first roundtable, is the idea that space is the product of relation and practices. And that I think, it's extremely important. And also the fact that we need to acknowledge our constitutive interrelatedness, and that implies a spatiality. So if we are trying to think how we are going to live together, or we are constituted in relation, there is necessarily a dimension of spatiality in that. And I think that, you know, something that many political theories don't really, you know, realize. And that's what I think the insight of Doreen are particularly important. And of course, she also insists that the nature of this spatiality should be a crucial avenue for political engagement and also for inquiry. So I think that there is really indicates, you know, a whole area of investigation for political theorists. The last point, also we have been referred to, is the role of power in the construction of specialized social practices. And here Doreen has brought a very important concept that she calls the geometries of power. It's a concept which has become extremely popular in Venezuela. In fact, Doreen was telling me that when she went there, all over the city, there were, you know, those big panels, Geometrias del Poder. But I do understand how, you know, people who really want, like Chavez, to transform relations of power and in Venezuela, dealing with all those, you know, regional, local things, are very inspired by this idea of geometries of power. And I think this is absolutely crucial for democratic politics. So those dimensions, the fact that, you know, space has got to do with multiplicity, that it's got to do with our constitutive interrelatedness, it's got always constructed in relation, which are always relations of power, and therefore is linked to, you know, geometries of power. Those are absolutely important insights for a political theory. Now what I would like to do is to speak to about two debates which are very important today among political theorists, but not only political theorists, in fact, because there are direct political consequences of the debate, in which I think the insight of the reader are very important, and that will, in fact, lead us to think in a different way as many people on the left are thinking at the moment. So the first one concerns the question of, you know, relation between global and local, again, that has been referred to in the first panel, and the question of globalization. Doreen has insisted that we need a politics of place prepared to defend but also to challenge the nature of the local, to scrutinize its role in the wider power geometries. Again, you know, the tendency, which I think is really a bit too, in certain circle of the left, a bit too dominant, that we should only think in terms of the global and dismiss local and regional attachment, you know, as being, in fact, some people will even go too far as saying that it's fascistic, you know, those kind of belongings. So we need only to think in terms of the local. Well, Doreen, of course, insists that this distinction between local, global must be exploded, that we need to understand, you know, that she says the global is locally constituted and the local is globally constituted. So it's very important not to dismiss the local. Of course, the tendency opposite to the one of advocating the global is to retreat in the local. And defend, you know, the local as the real place of authenticity. But this is precisely what Doreen showed us, that need to be this kind of, you know, binary opposition that needs to be exploded. And of course, this means, and here I refer directly to the debate, that this tendency to celebrate deterritorialization and advocate smooth space, I mean, all those people who are influenced by the work of Deleuze and Guattari, and sometimes even, you know, not really understanding exactly what they mean and trivializing those ideas. I mean, this is something that needs to be criticized. And Doreen also has insisted on the fact that space is always created. Space is constituted through relation of power. and through struggles. So this idea of a smooth space is in fact something that could not exist. There can't be a smooth space. Smith is necessarily striated because it is constituted through relation of power. And this is of course why, you know, as I've said before, the local is globally produced and the global is locally produced. And this is something, this, that goes against an important tendency again in the left to think in terms of cosmopolitanism. Of course, there are many different understandings of cosmopolitanism. In fact, some are even completely in contradiction with each other. But the main tendency, of course, of the cosmopolitan thinking is precisely to celebrate, you know, deterritorialization, to think that we only need to think in global, and that local attachment, local things are something which need to be overcome. I think that definitively is something that the work of Doreen put into question, and I'm definitively on her side on this debate. And this is why, for instance, I've been arguing for the need for a multipolar world. And I think that Doreen gives us insight to think of the way we should envisage this multipolar world. You know, when we were seeing in the first panel, the way in which there is a link between what's happening, what happening locally is always something that really has impact on outside. So we need to think in a multiplicity and not in terms of cosmopolitanism. The second debate, which is more directly political, is concerned the kind of politics that would be better suited to address those geometries of power. And here I will say that we can see among the left today, it's a bit, you know, simplistic to put it like that, but there, among some of the debate today, there is a tendency to envisage the project of the left in two different ways. One tendency, which is, I will say, not particularly dominant in certain left, certainly. In fact, to be honest, when I refer here to the left, I'm not referring to, you know, the kind of Blair left, center left, but to what, you know, I really consider will be a left politics, which not, we don't see much of it, unfortunately, for the moment in Britain nor for in Europe for that matter. So the tendency is to say, well, real left politics should consist in a withdrawal from the institution. And for instance, this is the tendency which is advocated by Hart and Negri in Empire and in Multitude, but also in the post-operaist thinkers like Paolo Virno. They argue that we should not engage with existing institutions. We should not have anything to do with the trade unions, with the political parties, with the state. We need to develop a politics of what I call exodus, a politic of desertion. So what is at stake is the creation of completely new relation outside of the existing institution. They want a form of democracy which is non-representative. They call that an absolute democracy. And what they see, you know, as a project is the acting in concert of the multitude beyond any form of legal system. For instance, this is, of course, the view that we find in Giorgio Agamben. And this is, I think, it's a kind of politics that does not take at all into account the spatialities and the way in which they are constructed in power relation. And against that tendency to think politics, you know, left-wing politics in terms of withdrawal from the institution, I've been advocating, and I think that, you know, I've found in Doreen a lot of inspiration for that, a strategy of engagement with. Of course, you know, here the concept of hegemony in Gramsci has been for me also very important, because I think that we should envisage left-wing politics in terms of an hegemonic politics which engage with existing institutions, which is a try to disarticulate, you know, the existing hegemonic hegemonies to address the nodal points around which the geographies of power are constructed. And of course, those nodal points are always spatially constructed. So I think that if we follow Doreen inside, then we are going to think of, borrowing a term from Gramsci again, a war, not a withdrawal from institution, but a war of position within the institution. You know, war of position is going to take place in many different social space, which is going to engage with existing institutions in order to create new form of articulation, which is going to try to transform the geometries of power, to create more democratic geometries of power. Of course, there is no possibility of a society which will not have some form of geometry of power. But there are some form of geometries of power which are more democratic than others. We should abandon this idea of an absolute democracy and try to, you know, construct a radical democracy, to radicalize democracy. And of course, I think that this also implies that we are going to try to construct chain of equivalence between different struggles. There is again a difference with the position of Hart and Negri, who believe that the struggle of the multitude necessarily, you know, converge, and that there is no need for political articulation. I think it's something which is, you know, very dangerous. Because in fact, as we know very well, among those democratic struggles, there are many contradictions. And we need to construct, you know, an unity, collective will across differences. And here I think that, again, this idea of constructing chain of equivalences is something that can borrow a very important insight from Doreen thinking precisely of those chains of equivalences across global and local. You know, not of course only local, but to envisage that in a multipolar way. So I think those are the two very important debates taking place today for which the insight of Doreen are, in my view, very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Chantal. Hello, Phil.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you for having me also. I'm exceptionally happy being here. I am the less likely to be here. I hope I'm not unlikely to be here because I'm the, let's say, considering the topic, the one who knows the least about it, but at least, nevertheless, I've been very influenced about it. And I think I can say my joy to be here is proportionally bigger. So I would like to share with you a couple of thoughts. I met Doreen more than 10 years ago. I was an art student, and as many art students in the early 90s, was very influenced by Deleuze and came from Deleuze to Bergson and started to enjoy much more polyphonic ways of thinking and, you know, needing more gravitas. We needed tools to, let's say, tie into more political systems. We needed doing tools. We needed, let's say, verbalizations of problems that felt emotionally a part of, you know, the world in which we live. So in a sense, a number of people, Doreen and Chantal certainly as well, it became important to kind of, let's say, suggest that the quality of space was in a much more complex way than when we went to school to be investigated, and through that one could find a particular, let's say, potentials. This, I hope, has inspired a body of work, or I think has inspired a body of work. Let me just mention, before we bring on the first picture, I have a few pictures I want to show you. When I came in, sitting down roughly in somewhere in the first talk, I sat down over there at the back, and it struck me, just to kind of suggest a way, give you a little tool of how I think, I was struck by the fact that the white screen or the white wall behind us was curved on the top, as you see. And I don't know whether it works the same way for all of you, but when I sat down and I thought to myself, well, isn't that funny for the Geographical Institute? They would have a curving wall. So I didn't look at the wall being flat. For me, it for some reason, sitting over there, probably seemed, you know, curving. And I thought, isn't that funny that you would project a flat two-dimensional image in this house in particular, and it would be kind of somewhat, three-dimensional, kind of radiantly kind of throwing, and you were sitting somehow around the image, until it struck me that it's not actually curved, the wall. It is, in fact, flat. And this, of course, just took like 1 or 2 seconds as you sit down. It is, in fact, flat, but it's an arch, because the blue line above it then shows you clearly looking for more than a second. It's an arch. Oh, and I said, oh, it's just a white wall as anything else. And then I thought, not getting into the first talk, I'm sorry. Then I thought, how would I know that it was flat had I not looked at the blue? Because I was interested in when is it, flat, representational, I could say. When is it curved and spatial? When is it, when does it have a body and when does it not? So I said, well, if I would walk in the kind of periphery of the space, I could see it by the time it takes for me to walk from there. The change in the geometry to the space would tell me that this is not a curved wall, this is a flat wall, because it would change accordingly. You being geographers, of course, knows this very well, but just the fact that, and this is in a sense nothing new in this way, but it has become something new. The fact that temporality would be so generous to us, the fact that we can use the time it takes for you to experience something as a tool to kind of measure the surroundings and engage in them. Do you see the potential in this, not just being a formal exercise, but actually reevaluating what does it mean to have a body and what does it mean to have, relationships with spatial entities. So having said this, let me just bump through, if we can turn the first slide on. Let me just bump through, that's the second. So the first one, that's an activist-like lookalike. Right? It's an action. I flew to Stockholm with a bag of green dye and dumped it in Strömmen, running through downtown Stockholm, roughly 10 years ago, dyeing the river green. And making it short, obviously most Scandinavian cities, like rest of Europe, have had an obsession with turning their cities into museums, regulating any sense of temporality out of the city. And as we know, a river is a great kind of trajectory of temporality, not just the kind of way the water flows, but also because it used to be the trade route and so on and so forth, as Doreen has told us. So I thought, why don't I put some temporality back in the town, at least for a couple of hours, which it takes for this green, non-toxic dye to run through the city, and so on and so forth. And the next day in the paper, the police had calmed down people calling the police, asking for the green collar, and the police had said that there was a leak in the governmental heating system, which is right on that first picture. So in Sweden, as we know, the regulatory ambition has an answer for everything, and the kind of state of calmness was quickly established in this way. But going from there, this is an EU-funded project in Utrecht, which is very flat. The west side of Utrecht, extra sun setting. And, of course, the west side of town, where all the not-so-fortunate midtown kind of toasters live, they would see this side of the sun. And clearly the representation deprived from time, or the sun not moving at least, in this case... This is then coming into the city also, but from the downtown you would have this sort of billboard-like, which is very much the destiny of downtown and the economy of facades and representations and the renderings of houses, the facade. And obviously the more generous side is in fact this, because there you are simply shared with the basic fact that it is a construction. It's not, another bloody sun. It's in fact just a construction, which led on to this project at the Tate Turbine Hall. And this is, Chantal sometimes has talked about an agonistic space where there was, within a frame of reference, a re-evaluation of the rules by which you organize yourself. And of course, it was unpredicted by me as well, but the whole setup turned into quite an interesting experiment for which Doreen was also involved in writing and lecturing at the time, which was the first time I actually talked Doreen into finally doing something with me. And look at this different kind of social organization, school kids trying to spell out things and have a... So it's a little community. Let me suggest it being a community where a kind of Where you could kind of combine the sort of idea of being together or having, you know, a social frame of reference, and yet a very generous and non-normative tolerance of other people doing something else than yourself. So in a sense, that was a very successful parliament, you could say, considering the kind of very kind of normative idea of what a European parliament has become today, at least. In that sense, it was very successful. Look at this couple there, a London couple. And I'm sorry, they're looking through a camera. How sad is that on top of it? But anyway, they're looking at themselves through a camera. And look at her. Look at what she does now with her head. She's just checking whether it's really her. So if you think about a museum, isn't that totally interesting? And of course, most museums are not like that, because they do not necessarily follow the talks of Doreen, in the sense that they have also become power systems. They have also become stigmatizing, and they have been obsessed by their own representation. They have become very paradoxical in the sense they talk about reflexivity and experience, and yet they are so normative in the way they treat people and the way they kind of pedagogically try to tell people about essentiality and, you know, essentialist rules about how to be good and bad, and so on. So this obviously is very important, and why I try to suggest that in this project, temporality, and Dorian also wrote a little piece of this at the Serpentine pavilion in front of the Serpentine Gallery, they have these pavilions every once in a while, and I did one with a Norwegian architect called Ketil Thorsen, and temporality was supposed to be the main issue, and we had a laboratory with a kind of a, you know, very weird mix of talking, and but of course the inside, the talks became the kind of vehicle for the activity or the idea of the building. So the content would somehow, let's say, generate the form, and the building itself would just be a kind of a ramp or a kind of temporal idea, allowing people to walk through. The last picture I want to show is a picture that is just from a project last year. It's interesting. For me, a very exciting project, because it's a waterfall, and I like waterfalls. And obviously, New York being what it is, and the skyline of New York being what it is, I have this sort of the legacy and the burden of this incredible, in one sense, great space, and the other sense, stigmatized space, especially due to, the American pragmatism of dealing with what does actually constitute a notion of public. And this project I did in close collaboration with Michael Bloomberg, and over the course of the time I got to know Michael quite well, and clearly we had very different points of view about what art is and does to a city, but nevertheless the challenge, which one could call a kind of a fiction, I think succeeded, because regardless of how much the city had invested in depriving my project from time, in the sense of making it into a branding or sort of a logo or somehow a spectacle, as spectacles has very little temporality, one could say, or Dorian says, the kind of friction that I had with the mayor was very inspiring, in the sense that I thought, well, one thing he can is probably communicate it wrong, but the water's going to keep falling. The water doesn't stop. Do you know what I mean? So I could, in my contract, say that you cannot do a press image of the piece. I don't want any images. Of course, it didn't work. But you see, I can, as an artist, I can use the tools that, in this case, I say it like this, Doreen gives me, to kind of make sure that the socializing potential, if you want to call it that, which is maybe limiting also, but the kind of generosity of the project stays within my hands. And I don't see any danger in then, testing it out, because not only do I speak for myself, I also have the extra comrade on my side, which is my work, which is the waterfall, and the water falls. So it does have time, and as water falls with roughly the same speed, being geographers everywhere. So looking at it, you also see how far away it is. You know, because far away, the waterfall falls slower, and closer it falls faster, and so on. So you see the distance between you and there. So finally, I want to say that I have just become a professor at the university in Berlin, suggesting opening an institute in the spirit of some of the thoughts that I've been going through, which has been very much inspired by Doreen, and it's called the Institute of Spatial Experiments. And one of the first people to speak is, in fact, a cosmologist who the whole idea Doreen also introduced me for. It's not the cosmologist you introduced me for, but a different one, and a dance, and a Cold War, a Cold War cybernetics guy, and a social activist. So those four people together is a very poor attempt, I'm sure, but nevertheless an attempt to put together, you know, time and space and, you know, the body in a social context, all in one, in terms of founding a new institute. It's a public school, which I'm very proud about. So thank you for that, Doreen.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I guess what you've all been doing in different ways is talking about reimagining, redoing urban space in particular in different ways. Doreen, would you like to respond? How are you feeling?
I'll just say one or two things.
Yeah, thank you.
All of those talks were utterly wonderful, and they were like, it brought together an awful lot of the different sides of things that have been happening in my life over a long period, and I'm really, really grateful for being able to listen to you all. One thing I'd quite like to reflect on comes out of that multiplicity, which is this business of talking beyond one's own discipline and how different it is in different directions. And so Chantal and I and Michael and I come from different disciplines, but it's quite immediate. There always is an issue of words meaning slightly different things in different contexts and a negotiation to be done before one can establish a conversation which means more or less the same to me as it does to the other person. But that kind of interdisciplinarity can work within a conversation. And I have hugely enjoyed it. I mean, some of the stuff Chantal and I are now bouncing back between us around multipolarity, the political problematical nature of a notion of smooth space, of a global commune, which doesn't leave a political possibility of challenging it, doesn't have an outside in that sense. All of those things are ways in which, quite unexpectedly, I found myself very, very closely talking to a political philosopher and finding it works. In conversations with the arts, it's completely different. And this time I actually did, and I want to talk in a minute about what I responded to and what you said, but quite often I have conversations and I go away and it's weeks before I know what was going on in them. Or I look at a piece of work and I know that it's been done somehow in conversation, and yet it takes me donkey's years before I understand at all, where it's coming from somewhere different and yet getting at the same kinds of things that I am. And I'm working at the moment with Patrick Keeler, who's here at the front, and we sometimes have conversations. So I'm sure we both walk away thinking, what was all that about? And then weeks later, can pick it up and carry on. So different, speaking beyond one's discipline in an academic sense is so fundamentally important, beyond all the cries of the academic establishment that we should do it and we should all set up centres and we should all do interdisciplinary stuff. Beyond all that, it's intellectually and politically important that we do it. And the only point I wanted to make was how different it can be in different kinds of dialogue, and that some take off just like that and some take a long, long time to mature into some kind of mutual intelligibility. But all of them, in my experience, have been utterly productive. Just wanted to make one point about our work together, because I think it has been, as you said, Oliver, very much about the integration of space and time, trying not to think them separately, because so often they're counterposed. And in particular, space is often thought of as the dimension without time. And that's one of the things I've been trying to dispel from our imagination for a long, long time. So I think both of the things I wrote with you are about, one of them is called Some Times of Space. But they're all about the way in which, I mean, space isn't just this flat surface of dead things, like Foucault said. You know, Foucault also criticizing the notion that it's the fixed and the dead. Space is this, in my way of thinking about it, it's a cut through the myriad of stories that are going on at any one moment. What I call it in For Space is a simultaneity of stories so far. So it's the fact that at this very moment something's happening in Afghanistan that we'll learn about on the news in the morning, that at this very moment it's beginning to get light in the Arctic. At this very moment people are getting up in Venezuela to start on another day of trying to build a new society. And it's that simultaneity of the spatial, but a simultaneity utterly imbued with temporality, which is one of the things that I've been getting at, and which is one of the things that, as Chantal said, that I've been going on about, makes it into the dimension of the social. It's space that's the dimension that presents us with the other, and therefore presents us with the challenge of living together. And I really hadn't quite picked up what Mike said about politics and the quality of these relations. I'd been thinking about it in a much more kind of global and interplace sense. And when you said that, and knowing where you're coming from in terms of your disciplinary affiliations, I just thought how general a concept that is, but also how important it is at this moment that we should really be insisting on this. Because we are once again at a moment, at some kind of conjunctural moment. Jamie spoke about the moment of spatial divisions of labour, the moment of World City. It was only 30 years. And yet that period has been the period of the dominance of what in shorthand we call neoliberalism, and it permeated all of life. That was the moment of a kind of relationality as non-relationality, relationality as individualism. And I think what might give us hope is the brevity of that period. It seems, I mean, that's the nature of hegemonies. They stop us thinking that there are alternatives. They get so inside our minds that we forget how deep, but it's an utterly deep common sense that we have been asked to and have imbibed. So to remember that it was brief, to remember that back in the 50s we thought completely differently, that equality wasn't a dirty word, that Keynesianism was obvious, and the state was a public good. But also to remember, and this takes me to Cairns, just how contested was the establishment of that neoliberal dominance over the last 30 years. I mean, when we were battling away in the GLC, I don't think I didn't know just what a cataclysmic decade that was. I didn't quite grasp the enormity of what was going on that we were up against, that it was a real conjunctural moment in which a new social settlement was being established. And it's that that has imploded now. And as Michael said, the difference is that settlement of that moment of the 1980s was provoked by, in a sense, the victory of forces of the left. I mean, the growth of social democratic forces, the success of trades union wage demands and so forth had pushed to a point where there had to be some kind of confrontation, and there was. And therefore there were social forces to be embattled. And we in the cities and others in the coalfields were part of those social forces. What's happened now, as Michael said, is quite different, that it's an implosion of their model, and we don't at this moment have the social forces kind of ready to do anything about taking that moment forward. And yet there are things that are happening. Just as an example that I gave to some other people, so it may be a repeat to some, but I mean, it's things like the Co-op is the most successful bank at the moment, yeah? There's an advert, which I, as I say, some of you know about this, but I love it. It's on Kilburn Station, but I'm sure it's in many places too. And it says, along the top, solid, stable, dependable. Underneath it says, exciting, aren't we? And it's an advert for a building society. And underneath it says, proud to be a building society. In other words, there's a kind of change of tone going on. That here we have mutuality being advertised as the thing which is good, rather than making the fast individualist buck. So there's something that can be picked up on. And there's huge discontents. I mean, right across Europe, and I mean, the latest places to erupt have been Guadeloupe and Martinique. There's huge things going on. And that's where I think, just to return to Chantal, that is exactly where we need to be thinking about a relation of politics, of building chains of equivalence. Those discontents in Greece, in Latvia, in France, in Guadeloupe, all sparked by different things, all in a sense against a similar frustration but could so easily be turned against each other. There isn't a natural affinity or a natural alliance between them. And one of the things I think we can do as journalists and academics and public intellectuals and artists is try and construct a different narrative, because at the moment this is an economic crisis. And I think what we have to do is turn it into a political crisis, one which brings together all those discontents and tries to weave a narrative that poses a challenge to the fundamental ways in which this society has gone wrong, the kind of thing that Ken was talking about, and tries to build connections between those discontents that enable us to look forward to a different kind of future. And there's a million other things I could say. I'm not going to say any more now. If you have some questions, maybe I'll pick up some of the other points then. Thank you.
Right, so over to you. Oh, great. Thank you. Yeah, first question.
Thank you. I'm a third year undergraduate at Goldsmiths, and very proudly. So, but I'd like to thank you very much for the local global the idea, the framework that you've offered. I'll be traveling to America to show them what British cultural studies is about, you know, and this is something I'm definitely going to push for. My point is really that you kind of gave us an idea of a globalization that is not necessarily cultural imperialism, you know. And the thing is, in the cultural studies perspective, as the Americans here, we can be a bit too political at times. And I think that's a criticism that I have as well. You kind of developed that, and I that's just my interpretation. And so the way I see it is that, you know, it's not necessarily cultural imperialism, and yet it's still political. And that's very valuable, I think. My problem today is this idea that Professor Mouffe discussed, this distinction that she made between multiplicity and cosmopolitanism. And that's this may be a matter of semantics, but let's say multiplicity are the processes that you kind of you identify in the global cities and that sort of thing. The way I see cosmopolitanism, and this may be a limitation. It may be a limitation that we cultural theorists have. I see cosmopolitanism as the cultural residue, which is vital to understanding cultural identity in modern day. This may have been a misinterpretation, Professor Mouffe, but you seem to kind of push for the multiplicity, yet negate the idea of cosmopolitanism. And this I find problematic. I don't want to cause any I'm just wondering. I was wondering if you could respond to this issue, perhaps together. Thank you.
Thank you. Should we maybe see if there are 2-3 other questions, possibly related, but don't have to be, just 2, and then we can have a more general response from the panel. I can see someone there.
Thank you. I had the opportunity of attending a conversation about the new, the celebration of the Communist Manifesto, and David Harvey has written the introduction for this new edition, and I was very lucky to be there. And of course, it was all about the current crisis, of course. And one of the things that he said was that he seemed to have hope in what has been happening in Latin America. which is where I happen to come from. And I just, if we place that hope within this idea of places, global and local, constituting each other, I can understand that we all have a concern for what the effect of this crisis might be in those places that seem to be more vulnerable. However, I wanted to ask, what role do you think that what is happening in Latin America, particularly in Venezuela or Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, might have to, what things could we learn from them? What role, what can they provide us in order to think about new geometries of power? So it's not just a concern for what the effects that these places could endure, but what can they give us as an answer? Thank you.
Thank you. I can see a couple more at the back. If we could...
I have a question, and I will try to formulate it in English. If not, I will tell you in Spanish. Okay. How can you talk about changing the narrative from economic crisis to political crisis if they are intimate related? I mean, economic now drives politics. I don't know if...
I just wanted to interrogate a space between something that Chantal said and something that Doreen said, which is between Doreen's celebration of the resurgence of mutualism and the dependability of various forms, yeah, in little ways, but also Chantal's dismissal of some of the political projects of exodus and non-hegemony. Because I think actually in those spaces of exodus and non-hegemony, whether in Chiapas, in Argentina, or through the European Social Movement Centres and other social centres movement, and other spaces like that, new experiments with new forms of mutuality have come about over the last 10, 15 years.
Thank you. Who would like to start? Chantal, you had a direct question, didn't you?
Yes,
like
yes. And I also will want to address the last one, which was also, you know. Well, as I say, you know, cosmopolitanism is so polysemic that it, and it's also become very trendy term. So there are multiple forms of cosmopolitanism. In fact, recently I've just heard about what they call local cosmopolitanism, which seems to be really an oxymoron for me, but you know, so everybody wants to be cosmopolitan. So I don't really know what maybe your understanding of cosmopolitanism, you know, is not a total contradiction with multiplicity. But here, I am not at all critical of cosmopolitanism if we understand by that a sensibility or even an ethos, you know, of openness to the world, to the other. Yeah, no problem with that. What I find very problematic is some political project, you know, of cosmopolitanism, which are designed by political theorists. And my main problem with those views, I won't give any names here, is that, in fact, all in different ways, they tend to advocate some kind of universalization of Western liberal democracy. When they think of, you know, a cosmopolitan world, and it will be on the basis that it is the form of course, to be absolutely honest, when they refer to liberal democracy, it's not really existing liberal democracy. In most cases, it will be some kind of social democratic liberal democracy. So it's because most of the people are on the left, you know, so they are very well intentioned. I'm not putting that into question. But their idea is that Well, our model of a liberal democracy, if it was really implemented, you know, that is the best model, is the universal model. It has got some specific take on rationality, and this is what, you know, all the people in the world, if they were, you know, able to reach our level of moral development, would accept, you know, us, their institution. And this is what I'm putting into question, because I think that, you know, it is at and this is central into political theory. Most of political theory is trying to show that liberal democracy is really, you know, the best form of democracy. And so there is definitely no place for a multiplicity. For I personally am in favor of what I call the idea that democracy, I'm not saying that democracy is something, you know, only good for the West, but I think that the democratic ideal, if we understand by that, you know, the rule by the people, could be inscribed differentially in different cultural, civilizational contexts. And that, for instance, I know there are people who are trying to develop what they call an Islamist form of democracy, a Muslim form of democracy, other, you know, Confucian form of democracy, and I'm very much in favor of that, because I think that the world is a pluriverse, it's not a universe. So this is the kind of democracy, of cosmopolitan, that I find really very problematic. Concerning the question of my critique of exodus, well, I mean, you made reference to Argentina, and I think that's precisely the best example I will use against this form of politics, of not engaging with the institution, you know, not wanting to get you know, dirty with working with the state. And we know what happened in Argentina with the movement of the Piqueteros at the beginning of the, you know, this century. They were very strong. They managed to bring down the La Rúa government. So it was, of course, an incredible moment of, you know, getting imagination, doing things, except that their motto was que se vayan todos, no? They must all go away. So, well, when the La Rúa government fell, then there were election, and of course the Piqueteros, it's absolutely no way in which they could even influence the election. I mean, things turned out quite well, because finally Kirchner won. Imagine it would have been the Menem. That would have been a total catastrophe. But Kirchner turned up to be much more left than people would have dreamed of. So things are much better in Argentina at the moment than they were before. But the Piqueteros, with their strategy of, you know, exodus, desertion from the traditional institution, that clearly showed the limits of that. Because if you really want to construct a different society, you need to engage with the institution in order to transform them, not just say, well, you know, we are leaving, that's que se vayan todos. And I think that's the best example of the limitation of that kind of strategy. I'm not saying that one should not also try to create new form, but always, you know, in trying to create them as rearticulation of existing institutions, not simply trying to, you know, do that outside. But it's very important to address the actual geometries of power, transfer them, rearticulate them, and not having this strategy of desertion.
Globalization could have created a cultural imperialism. But one thing, I think, makes it impossible. Back in 1964, Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book speculating about all the possible futures we faced. He had a chapter in which he posited the question, we will either develop instantaneous travel or instantaneous communication. And you only need one of those. And, of course, as we know, we haven't got Star Trek beam me up, Scotty. So what we have got, though, is instantaneous communication. And it embraces billions of people. Even in sub-Saharan Africa, somewhere between 20 and 25% of people have a mobile phone. And whereas, I think, after the collapse of communism, and all the Huntington stuff about clash of civilizations and the implosion of the Japanese economy. And I remember, I can't remember who wrote it now, a book about the 21st century will be American and so on. And this just isn't happening. It isn't happening because all over the world, hundreds of millions of people, mainly younger people, are developing a mix-and-match approach to culture. They're taking what they want. You're beginning to see Bollywood changing Hollywood. Because all over the world, people are making their choices through their iPods, their Blackberries, their mobile phones, their computers. I mean, the International Olympic Committee are really terrified because the average age of the people who watch it at television, which is where they make their big bucks from the networks, is now 55 years old. And they want to make sure that come the Games in 2012, there's all these young people sitting in watching it in their computers and interacting and so on. And that is the way it will develop. And you just can't get a cultural hegemony anymore because people can choose what they want. And it's not like, you know, in the late 1940s where 45% of productive capacity was in the United States of America and it had the power to impose. I mean, they had to pass around the bloody hat now to be able to invade Afghanistan, for God's sake. That, those days are gone. And I think it will be the openness of cultures. I mean, I think Japan's implosion had a lot to do about the intense levels of xenophobia that exist in that society. The failure of Tokyo to rival New York in the way London was able to is because only 2.5% of the people in New York are foreigners. You can't have a great world city which isn't awash with people from all the way around the world. And the test will be for Mumbai and Shanghai as they grow. Are they going to be genuinely multicultural? And I think they will. And so, I mean, I'm really optimistic about it. I don't fear a globalization creating a new cultural hegemony. And you actually look at the fracturing of what people watch on television, the dozens and dozens of options and all that. The days when, in Dorian and my generation, everyone sat at home and watched the same bloody program and came in and talked about it, and they say, are gone. There is no power on earth, even a successful, eventual superpower of China, capable of imposing that. It's just gone, and it's gone because of Arthur C. Clarke's prediction about instantaneous communication. Once you've got that, and you can't block it, and you can't control it, you can't censor it, and all that will break down. We will choose the future we want.
One of the few last standing places where people sit down and share a collective space is the weather forecast. Being in this context, I thought it was awesome. Yeah.
Michael, do you want to...
Well, I just want to say one thing about the relation between politics and the economy. And I want to put it in this way. Here we have an implosion and a general view that the financial sector can't have quite the same dominant role in London that it's had before. So what is to be done instead? What are people to work at? What are they to produce? What are to be the main content of economic activity? And how do we even think about it? It's quite difficult to think about because the way the government thinks about it is always in terms of aggregates. Quantitative easing, so there'll be more money, there might be a bigger deficit. We have the big magnitudes, but the content of what is to be done is below the field of decision or even thought, because that's to be left to the market. Now, contrast this with what Ken and Doreen and Vella and Robin Murray were doing in the London Labour Plan, when they thought it was absolutely essential to grasp and name the kinds of things that people did in order that one can even begin to make decisions about them, like how should waste be disposed of, or how should the environment be dealt with, or what about the development of creative industries? So there was a precedent in the work that they did then about at least trying to map, name, and describe the fields of economic activity we have in order that there could be some possible decision about them. We're not even at the point at the moment of having a description or even the possibility of a description within the orthodox economic discourse. And without a description, it's quite hard to have a politics.
On the politics and economics, I mean, yes, of course, there is... a clear relation between the two. But I absolutely agree with Michael. I mean, the way in which the economic crisis is being faced at the moment in the popular media, in the dominant discourses, is through a narrative which is within the economic and which is on the whole from the right. And what we need to do is to re-articulate those things, what is going on at the moment in a political discourse which challenges more deeply the economic things that are happening and turn it into a political crisis about the tone of society, about the way in which we do live together, that goes much, which goes beyond the economic, because that in the end is what is at issue. And finally, on the globalization and cultural imperialism, there is a number of questions that related, and I just wanted to say one or two things. There is occasionally, sometimes, also a cultural imperialism on the left. This is not to disagree with what Ken said, but when I say I'm working in Venezuela, the immediate thing is that people judge it. Ah, but he's a dictator, isn't he? Or whatever. And that's a kind of immediate judgmentalism, that we know the model here. We know what's a good politics. And we will judge what's going on in Venezuela by what we have here. And I'm not saying there should be no judgment, that there should be no evaluation. But on the other hand, what's happening in China, what's happening in Venezuela or Bolivia, comes out of long, long histories and battles that they themselves are fighting, that we shouldn't just simply and very briefly judge by criteria which have come out of our history and our battles. And so the first thing I'd say is that we must get away from that kind of implicit cultural imperialism of the left and learn to learn. Because I do think what's going on in Latin America is enormously important, and it's potentially even more important if we try to learn from it. The way in which my concept, as it were, power geometries was taken up there has been in order to try and establish participatory democracy, which takes democracy right out across the country to regions whose voices have never been heard before, to poorer barrios in some of the big cities whose voices have never been heard before, to try and build, and this is in non-elective communal councils, which are places trying to form collectives, another form of power. So not only the geometry, in a sense, the geography of the power being changed by coming from poor barrios and regions in the Orinoco or the Amazon, but also the nature of the power, which is participatory and collective, as opposed to the individual voting kind of power that comes out of representative democracy. So I learned a huge amount about what power geometry meant by that. I also learned, to return to the discussion with Oliver, about the temporalities of power, because one of the difficulties in what they're trying to do is that while Chavez's power is very quickly established by law, by the fact that he's the president, the power that comes from the base takes donkey's years. People who've never known how to speak before, people who never thought they had the right to have a political voice, learning to participate, learning collective decision-making, that takes years. And so within this new proposed geometry of power in Venezuela, there are multiple temporalities, and sometimes they're dislocated one from the other, and I'd never thought of that before. So being involved in Venezuela, I've learned enormously about something I thought I was suggesting. And the final thing I'd say is that I think one of the things that's important about what's going on in Venezuela and the rest of Latin America is that it does involve that relationality of place from which we started. There's a very strong determination to have an outward-looking politics of place. And I think I was probably, well, one amongst a very small number, if not the only person arguing in favor of Ken's initiative for the agreement between London and Caracas. And I thought that was fantastic demonstration that you don't have to have neoliberal relations between places. You can have equal exchange between places apparently in such different positions within the inequalities of globalization, that places don't have always to compete with each other. They can cooperate. It stood for all of that. And it is no accident that after that strange and eerie pleasantries that you and Boris Johnson exchanged immediately after the election, the first way in which Boris Johnson broke that peace was to abolish the agreement between London and Caracas. He knew that politics of place beyond place and ones that challenge the current hegemony really matter. They have symbolic and real political potential, and that's what we should be getting on and doing more of. Thanks anyway.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.